Chapter 17. Greaves was forced to wait for his moment, and it was a long time in coming. But when the soldiers went to their stations and the science team started to look around for the first specimen to work on, the opportunity was suddenly there. He stepped backwards off the street into the window display of a shop, whose glass frontage had long ago been shattered. Faceless mannequins dressed in sun-bleached rags jostled him, but he steadied them with both hands and passed on through. In the space of a second, he had become invisible. He pauses now to savour that feeling. Privacy and anonymity appeal to him strongly. The interior of the shop has a rich smell of damp and rot. Sodden cloth, mulched down 2 or 3 inches thick, sucks at his feet as he walks. He gropes his way through interior doors, passageways, storerooms, back out onto an alley so narrow that he has to keep his body flat to the wall as he walks. The sound of the river is loud in his ears. It must be close at hand, probably on the other side of the rough cast wall that faces him. He comes out onto a side street, finds it deserted. Picking another shop, he dives in through the gaping, dislocated doorway and keeps on going. Greaves moves quickly, even though he has no idea where he is going. He's painfully aware of how little time he has. On previous excursions, when he has struck out from Rosie on his own, he has chosen a time when nobody had any expectations of him or any reason to look for him. This time is different. This time he is on the mission roster, and his absence is bound to raise alarms as soon as it gets noticed. And normally, Greaves has a plan. But this time, no. He was lured astray by the urgency of his desire. His strongest passion, sometimes his only passion, is for explanations. When he encounters something that runs so contrary to his understanding of the world, he needs to interrogate it until it yields to his intellect. This time, though, it's more than just a quirk of his nature. Understanding the children may lead him to a cure for cordyceps, a medicine for all the world's ills. Somewhere in this town, the children are hiding. And the town is so small it seems that he must inevitably run into them. But that feeling is an illusion mostly attributable to his having grown up in Beacon. Beacon began life as a camp. Its structures are mostly single-story. Thousands of people live in tents, or in temporary shelters that have insidiously become permanent. By contrast, a town from before the breakdown, even a town as small as this one, is an upside-down rabbit warren in which spaces proliferate, vertically upwards. Every building is made of many rooms, with more rooms piled on top of them and more above those and so on. Not quite ad infinitum, but in London, Greaves sometimes met his own limits halfway up a glass and stone tower that reared itself so high above the ground his stomach seized and cramped with nausea whenever he looked out of a window. Greaves knows his way here, is confident that he will not get lost. He has memorized the Ordnance survey map of Invercrae, and he has perfect recall of his journey of the previous night. Even so, it's hard to align these vivid, fractal spaces with the idealized abstract presented by the map. Uncertainties proliferate. A room he passes through is full of shoes piled as high as the ceiling. Wellington boots and high heels, slippers and sandals and baby shoes. Across walls and windows in the next street is a mural painted in a rust-brown colour that reminds Greaves of dried blood. A man, a woman, and a child arm in arm, smiling. Memorial? Magic charm? Mere insanity? The river is his guide of last resort, but it betrays him. Following its sound, he traps himself in a dead end bounded on 3 sides by high, windowless walls. This does not correspond to anything on the Ordnance survey map, and almost certainly postdates it. Greaves is starting to panic a little. He steps through a doorway into a fetid corridor, whose carpet had become an indoor garden of weeds and lichen. He has neither claustrophobia nor agoraphobia, but any unfamiliar place has the potential to become an enemy. It would be a comfort right now to lie down and cover his face in his hands. He has to force himself to keep moving. He tries to retrace his steps, but rising adrenaline assails and confuses him. His memory, normally indelible, begins to blur at the edges. He is in a dark room, walking into walls, tripping over indeterminate objects. Another room. A third. Filtered daylight beckons to him. He blunders out into a large enclosed yard, a vehicle bay for cars that died long ago. One is up on blocks, another missing its doors and windscreen. He can see the sky at last and a gate through which he can exit to the street. He bolts, gets to the gate, through the gate, then stops dead in his tracks. The sound of weapons firing bounces off his skin and off the walls around him. What makes Greaves freeze and look around, bewildered, is not the volume. The soldiers always use suppressors, because where all animals bolt away from loud, sudden noises, hungries run straight towards them. So this is not a boom of thunder. It's just the hawk and spit sound he has become used to. But it's full auto, and it's close. So who is firing? And what have they hit? Chapter 18. Private Lutz is an engineer first and a soldier second, although actually the gap between the two roles is bigger than that suggests. He never wanted to join the army, but after 3 years on the dole he did very much want a proper apprenticeship that he could turn into a proper job. A 4-year army contract, he reasoned, would see him at age 25 walking into a sweet deal at Swain's or Eddie Stobart's with a good chance of having his own garage somewhere down the line. Then the breakdown happened. The hungry plague. And here he is, more than a decade later, still stuck in his fatigues in a world where even engineers who never enlisted belong to the army by default. To be fair, he loves his job. Or at least the part of his job that consists of taking broken machines and making them sing and dance by the application of his skilled hands. That gig is magic. It's zen. It's the perfect piece of the unclouded mind, so completely engaged that it's somehow completely free. But he hates all the rest of this shit. Hates being taken away from his real work to do things that don't mean anything, for people who aren't grateful. Particularly hates being outside the beacon perimeter fence, at the moment 400 miles outside, and at risk. If he's happiest with a spanner in his hand, a rifle fills him with a kind of disgust. Spanners take things apart, yes, but they put them together again, too. With a rifle, all you can do is dismantle. Feeling hard done by, he trudges through the streets of Invercrae looking for Stephen Greaves. And wouldn't he like to open that one up with a spanner? Lots of fascinating things to be discovered inside Greaves's cranium, no doubt. Although the robot is the very definition of NSK, non-standard kit. If you wanted to fix him, you'd need to make your spare parts from scratch, by hand. The sun comes out for a minute or so, and Lutz's spirits lift. He walks on the sunny side of the street for as long as it lasts. Then the cloud closes in again and the sky is all watery porridge. That seems to be the normal state of affairs in this miserable bit of the world. The private is so lost in his thoughts that he loses a second in responding when he hears the sound. Just the chink of metal or stone on glass, but an intentional sound is different from what the wind or the rain does. It has its own profile that is hard to mistake. Something is moving in the building on his right-hand side. Moving quietly, but the deserted town provides no cover, no distractions. After the clink, a shuffle. Perhaps the hiss of a barely voiced command. These things add up to ambush. Lutz saw the Hungries hacked and felled like trees, and has no wish to end up the same way. He has been moving with his safety on as per regs, but now he flicks it free and... he doesn't even have to think about it. Fires. The rifle is on semi-auto, stepped down, but Lutz has the trigger in a death grip. He empties his magazine in 3 seconds, remembering to fan diagonally downwards and to the left for maximum coverage. The shop front explodes as the bullets rip through glass and brickwork. Hollow point, yes, but maximally configured for shallow penetration. These mixed alloy mosquito-nosed rounds will bite 3 inches deep into anything, then repent and weep molten metal when they get there. The sound is deceptively soft, like papers being incautiously toppled from a desk and scattering across the floor. Immediately followed by shrill yips of pain or shock and the sudden concerted movement of many bodies. It was a trap, and he triggered it. Too bad for the trappers. In the exhilaration of that moment, of ducking the blow and turning the tables, Lutz loses all perspective. He does the last thing in the world he should do. He charges into the shop, where drifts of brick and plaster dust make the air into a cocktail whose main ingredient is wall, and on through an open doorway into the depths of the building in pursuit of his fleeing enemies. He reloads as he runs and fires again, full auto this time. There's nothing to fire at, but fuck it. These guys thought they could wait in the dark for him and trip him as he passed by, cut his tendons and leave him crawling in the dust the way they did the Hungries. Well, let them try a taste of that and see how it goes down. Out the back door, into a closed courtyard where eviscerated black bags bleed ancient, unidentifiable rubbish. Then into the street. Now he can see the fleeing shapes ahead of him, heads down and bodies low to the ground as they run flat out. They look too small. Perspective, probably. He gets off another burst and one of them falls. One of them is down. He's actually made a kill. He jumps right over the prone body and keeps on going, processing what he saw slowly and piecemeal in the seconds that follow. He's got his mind on the chase, lunging into another building, an office of some kind, through cubicle farms now empty of all livestock, inspirational posters exhorting him from the walls. Just hang in there. But then the penny drops and echoes round his skull. A kid. It was a kid. They're all kids. And they've stopped running now. Lutz stops too, stares at them in utter wonderment. He can't imagine what they're doing here, where their parents are, where they got their ridiculous trick-or-treat costumes from. No, they're not dressed for Halloween. Although one of them has turned his face into a stylized skull. The rest seem to be playing dress like Mummy and Daddy do, with about the same hit rate that kids normally average. Dear Christ, he just killed a kid. He opens his mouth to apologize, to explain, to reassure, but right at that moment, one of the children, the skull-faced boy, whips his arm around like a jockey urging his horse towards the last fence. There's a sensation in Lutz's left eye like a door slamming shut. A big steel door with a lot of weight and heft to it. A second, bigger impact turns out to be the ground, standing on its end to smack him hard. Now he's lying on fouled carpet tiles and his thoughts have slowed to a syrupy crawl. The children's feet appear in his monocular field of vision. His left eye is welded shut, stepping softly and cautiously around and over him, as though he might still have some fight left in him. Don't be scared, he slurs. It's okay. It's okay. But they're not. And it isn't. Chapter 19. Greaves sees the body as soon as he rounds the corner. He looks to the left and right, quickly. His first reaction is simple confusion. Why would the children leave one of their number to lie where he has fallen, like one more bag of spilled rubbish in a street that seems to offer nothing else? Bodies are not rubbish. Bodies in the field, bodies of Hungries, are specimens. Bodies in Beacon are important for other reasons. Ceremonies, memories, regrets. One way or another, it seems, this body should be tended to. Noises reach Greaves's ears, muffled by a wall or two, but very close. Running feet, the crash of something falling. Something is in the middle of happening, which, it's not an unreasonable inference, might have forced the children to defer the decision of what to do with this corpse. In the space between two breaths, Greaves feels a decision swell to ripeness inside him. He scans the street again, quick and tremulous to make sure he is not observed. He is keenly aware of the danger here. The children are much faster and stronger than he is. There is no way he could either fight them or outrun them. But the enigma, the impossibility, is drawing him on like a hook tugging at his brain. The children are hungries, but they don't respond like hungries. They can still think and feel. Higher brain functions have not been completely erased. He needs to understand them. Needs it on a level so fundamental that his nerves are screaming at him to move. To forget the risk and just do it. What does his physical safety matter? What terrors does death hold compared to having to live without answers? He's moving forward, out into the open where the body lies. He's kneeling beside it. He tries to postpone investigation, analysis, but it is obvious to a cursory inspection that the boy has received two bullet wounds, either of which would most likely have been fatal. One bullet has passed directly through the throat, the other, Greaves moans aloud in dismay, has punched through the boy's left temple and more or less obliterated that side of the brain. Greaves is shaking, less from the perception of danger than from the sheer mental pressure of what this find might mean, the piled-up weight of possibilities. He can't think about it. If he thinks about it, that weight will fall on him and he will freeze in place. He slides his hands underneath the boy's shoulders and knees. There is no weight there. It's as though he's holding a ventriloquist's doll, a hollow replica of a boy. The ruined head falls against him. Greaves remembers lying like this in his mother's arms, when he was so young that he couldn't speak in full sentences. Remembers lisping the word bedtime, and his mother laughing out loud at his precociousness. "Listen to that! He knows the drill, don't you, my love?" Under the sour tang of blood, the boy's body smells like a forest floor, warm and damp and old. Greaves scoops the little broken thing up in his arms and runs. Not to the main street, but to the river. The map has activated in his mind. There is a way back to Rosie that doesn't go past the science team and the soldiers. It goes instead through reeds and bracken, through ribbons of sand and shallows back to the bridge. A voice shouts behind him, Lieutenant McQueen's, but the words are impossible to make out and Greaves doesn't think the lieutenant is calling out to him. The boy's head slides down into the crook of his elbow. The blood that stains Greaves's overalls is more brown than red, although there's certainly some red in there too. He can see the parapets of the bridge up ahead now, and he slows involuntarily, starting to see how hard a task he has set himself. How is he going to do this? Getting back on board Rosie by himself is complicated, but not impossible. Carrying the dead body of a child through the airlock is a very different proposition. He will need to vary his route so that he doesn't go by the cockpit. But that won't be enough. With a team in the field, it's more than likely that either the Colonel or Dr. Fournier will have taken manual control of the airlock, and will be waiting there to check the crew back in when they come. If he evades them at the airlock, they will still hear him enter and come to greet or debrief him, thinking that his arrival heralds the return of the team. Perhaps he should hide the body and come back to retrieve it later. But that opens up the possibility that the children will search for it and claim it back. In fact, if their sense of smell is as strong as that of regular hungries, they won't even need to search. They'll just go straight to it. Greaves has reached the bridge, and now he starts to climb the steep bank that leads up to the parapet. He picks his way one-handed, the cooling weight of the corpse pressed hard against his chest. He has to find a way back into Rosie, before the rest of the field team arrive there. He has to stow the body where it can't be found, and he has to make sure that no questions are asked about his own absence, because if they are asked, he will have to answer them. Right then is when the stone wall of the bridge starts to vibrate under his hand. He takes a step back and looks across the river. He won't need to go to Rosie. Rosie is coming to him, with her airlock and extensor wings drawn in and her guns elevated. She roars down the narrow, overgrown road and out onto the bridge, which is barely wide enough to take her. The weeds are trampled and torn up by her treads, rise again behind her in a column of green confetti. An angle of the parapet wall, struck by the edge of her front-end ram, explodes. Chunks of stone as big as clenched fists fly over Greaves's head as he ducks and covers. Rosie is level with him. Then she's past him. Then she's gone. She didn't even slow. It seems his problem has just become part of a wider problem. Chapter 20. After Lutz has been gone for 20 minutes, McQueen tries to raise him on the walkie-talkie. When that fails, he calls a halt to the sampling and orders a search. There is no question of splitting the team up. If there is an enemy out there who is picking them off one by one, the lieutenant is damned if he's going to make their job easier for them. They search the main streets first, then the side streets. They stay clear of the buildings where anyone so inclined could mount an ambush in the time it takes to blink. Searching the interiors will be a last resort. The scientists have put their sampling gear away and have rifles at the ready. McQueen only hopes they remember which end of the bastard things to point with. They don't find either Lutz or Greaves at first, but on one of the side streets they pick up a trail. Dr. Khan sees it first. She has the sense not to shout. She touches McQueen's shoulder and points in silence. Her face is pale. Most likely she is thinking about Greaves, who is her protege, pampered pet, and just possibly, he is only a kid, but you have to wonder, the one who knocked her up. What Khan has seen is blood, which, as far as bad news goes, is the first, but not the worst. There's a broad pool of the stuff out in the middle of the street, fresh enough that it's still tacky to the touch. A set of booted footprints leads from it into the nearest building. It looks as though Lutz hit something here and brought it down. But maybe he didn't hit it hard enough, because whatever it was, it's not here anymore. It looks to the lieutenant as though it took off towards the river. There's a second, fainter trail of dark red smears and spatter patterns that leads off in that direction. "Oh my God," Celie mutters. And Penny, who is no shrinking violet, shakes her head violently as if she's refusing to admit that any of this is happening. Whatever went down and didn't die is still a potential threat. They would be stupid to turn their backs on that, but Lutz is the priority, and he should be easier to find now they've got a vector. Most of all, McQueen thinks, he's got to get this done before the civilians start to fall apart. "Foss, on my six," he raps out. "Phillips, Sixsmith, stay out here. Cover both ends of the street and the river. Anything happens, even if it's a cloud in the sky, you squawk me." "Yes, sir," Phillips says. "Can I come with you?" Khan asks. "If Stephen is in there..." "I'll call out if I need you," the lieutenant says. It doesn't mean anything, but it shuts her up. He walks into the building, with Foss stalking silent at his back. She has left her M407 in its canvas sheath holster across her shoulders. It's a liability in a narrow space. In its place she holds a Glock 22, whose magazine, McQueen knows, is filled with bespoke rounds that Cat makes herself using the 40 Smith & Wesson case as a starting point, and a 357 powerhead contact shooter. Good choices. He's bringing Sixsmith's SCAR H to the party, so they've got both ends covered. The surgical and the indiscriminate. But they don't need either, because the party is over. Lutz lies on his back, staring one-eyed at the ceiling. The eye that looks as though it's winking has in fact been permanently closed by a smooth grey stone that has embedded itself in the socket. The blood welling up around it has already begun to scab. The private's throat has been slit so deeply that the top of his spine has been severed. Nubs of bone glisten in the blackness of the wound. There are a number of other wounds distributed widely across his limbs and torso, incised and abraded in any damn flavour you can think of. Whoever killed him brought a lot of energy to the task, and a lot of implements. One of the implements lies on the ground beside him, a knife. But not a knife that was designed to be a weapon. It has a short blade and a sculpted plastic handle. The Kitchen Devil logo adorns it. "Where are you, you bastards?" Foss whispers. She turns a quick circle looking for a target. She already has a round in the chamber and her finger is tight on the Glock's finely balanced trigger, where half a foot-pound of extra energy will push the bullet down the slipway. "Stand down," McQueen orders her. In case that's not enough, he grips her wrist and points it at the ground. His own instincts are the same as hers. He was playing poker with Lutz less than 12 hours ago. He has spent a lot of the last 7 months listening to the man's bad jokes and untenable claims about how good he is at the nearly extinct game of table football. So yeah, he wants to find who did this and teach them the going rate for eyes and teeth. But it's a luxury he can't afford. He doesn't know the ground, and he is heading up a force that balances 3 actual soldiers against 4 armed liabilities. You can't churn butter with a toothpick, no matter how much you might want to. Go to ground, then, and get their licks in later. But as a fortress, this place doesn't thrill him. Too wide, too open, too many doors, walls too thin to stop a sneeze. Lines of sight fuck awful in every direction. He throws Foss the signal to retreat in good order, and she knows better than to argue. They back out the way they came, leaving Lutz's thoroughly tenderized remains where they lie. It hurts like hell, but it's the only thing to do. Out on the street, McQueen rounds up the geeks, who predictably are full of questions he doesn't have time to answer. "Lutz is dead," Seely keeps repeating, as if he can scrape the unpalatable fact away by abrasive repetition. Dr. Khan grabs McQueen's arm, which he doesn't like overmuch. "What about Stephen?" she demands. "Did you find him?" "There's no sign of him," he tells her. "Probably means he's lying low somewhere. We'll get to him when we can."
"When we can?"
Khan spits the words out as though they're poison.
"We've got to find him now before we do anything else."
McQueen wants to grab her by the throat and shout in her face that Greaves caused this by wandering off in the first place. Greaves brought Lutz this hideous, unseemly death. But he doesn't say that, because it's the part of the truth that matters least. The senior officer takes the decisions and the rap. Everything that's happened here is down to him, first and last. So he just pulls his arm sharply away from her grasp and gives the order again. "Follow the leader, single file, 10 yards apart. Start and stop on my mark. If any of you steps out of line, I'm going to handcuff them and frog march them, which will be bad news for everybody." Khan looks like she's inclined to argue again, but then she thinks better of it. The fact of Lutz's death is sinking in. Her face twists in surprise and pain, as though something sharp just dug into somewhere soft. Well, it's tough all over. Every one of them can see that they're playing a bad hand in a bad place. "Single file," he repeats. "Don't close up." McQueen leads them away from the killing ground, sticking to the shadows and the angles of walls, spacing them out along a skirmish line, making them as difficult a target as he can. They're being followed. Something is fucking pacing them. The enemy don't let themselves be seen, not clearly. But there are flicks of movement from the buildings on either side, skitters of sound. Again, McQueen is tempted to cut loose, but the middle of the street is no place to make a stand. Dig in first, then see what comes, unless the bastards force the issue. They don't. The lieutenant gets the science team into cover in what used to be the corn exchange. He manages to find a place he can actually fortify. A first-floor room with a wide view of the street and a flat roof at the back that will make a good line of retreat. He establishes a perimeter about 20 feet across. He calls Rosie, tells the colonel they're in a hole they can't climb out of, and if he can find time in his busy schedule to stop by, the field team will be delighted to see him. Informal dress, guns prepped, and armour up. Carlyle doesn't bother asking questions he doesn't need the answers to. "Wait there," he orders McQueen. And McQueen does. Meanwhile, he finds a nice place to sit by the window with his rifle resting in his hands. "Come on, you bastards. Let's see you." But there's nothing to see now. Nothing moving. The only sound is a pigeon cooing from up on the roof. The radio is silent for 3 minutes, which is the time it takes to retract the airlock and the extension blisters. When the colonel pings them back, McQueen can hear the sound of Rosie's engines in the background, already warming up. Evidently he succeeded in conveying a suitable sense of urgency. Foss and Sixsmith have got the windows. Phillips is at the door, which he's cracked open 7/8 of an inch with the barrel of his rifle right up against the gap. The whitecoats are sitting in a tight circle on the floor, facing outwards. They've got their guns at the ready, but McQueen has told them to keep the safeties on. He is not going to put his own or his people's skins in between a terrified amateur and a moving target. Khan is as pale as a sheet, and her hands are shaking. Funny, he would have thought she would be one of the last to lose her nerve, but she's sweating it for the robot, of course. The radio squawks again, Carlyle asking for a GPS. McQueen gives him both that and his take on the situation. "It's quiet right now, but they're close, and I think they'll make a move before you get here." "I'll bring Rosie right to you," Carlyle says. "ETA 2 minutes. Use the time to locate enemy positions if you can. Anything you spot, I'll light up from the street before I retrieve you." "Copy," McQueen says tersely, and he doesn't bother with out. Khan is practically gnawing her fist off. Her eyes show darker than ever in her bleached-out face. "Can we try to send Stephen some kind of message?" she asks McQueen. "So he can find us?" "Like what?" Foss snaps, reaching the end of her tether. "A fucking smoke signal." "We don't want him to find us," Private Sixsmith says with less of an edge. "It wouldn't be a good idea for him to come into the open right now. He's better off keeping his head down until we come." She glances across at McQueen as though McQueen might have an opinion on this. The lieutenant doesn't say a word, and prominent among the words he doesn't say are small loss. He is much more concerned with the silence and stillness out in the street. The enemy were practically treading on their heels, and now they've disappeared. It doesn't make any sense. "How long will we have to wait here?" Akinwe demands. There is no answer to that question that will do justice to the lieutenant's feelings, but he's about to give it a shot when something he has been noticing subconsciously makes it into the forefront of his mind. That sound he just heard was wings. Birds taking off from the roof. He looks up. Listens. When Akinwe starts to speak again, he grunts a terse, "Shut up!" A loosened pebble chatters and chuckles its way down the roof ridge. McQueen aims at the ceiling. The next thing that moves is going to get a bullet, just to make a point. But the next thing that moves is Penny. She screams as the window shatters, showering her with broken glass. She goes down into a crouch, clutching her face. That was no gunshot. It came in on a curved trajectory, and it lost height too fast. McQueen guesses what it was even before he sees the pebble lying on the naked floorboards at his feet. A stone out of a slingshot. He snaps his fingers to get the white coat's attention. "Take off your coats," he says quickly. "Now, wad them up and cover your faces. A headshot is the only thing that can actually kill you." They scramble to do it, all except for Penny, who is still praying to Mecca. Akinwe asks if she's hit, but she's not answering. A slingshot is a low-tech weapon, even by Junker standards, but it's effective. Much more worrying are the scraping and wrenching sounds from right over their heads. The bogeys are ripping the slates off. They're going to come in through the roof. Needs must. McQueen strafes the ceiling with a short, wide burst,
doing more damage than their unseen assailants, but at least he's breaking up their party. As he does this, the rest of the windows blow out. Small chunks of stone punch the plaster on the far wall with impacts as crisp and clean as bullets. One of them hits him in the back, but his pack absorbs most of the force. "Lie down," he orders the science team, and they do. The soldiers are down too, on their knees and peering at an oblique angle around the edges of the broken windows, trying to get a glimpse of the enemy without swallowing a piece of ballistic geology. "Foss," McQueen snaps. "Phillips." He points at the ceiling, where the sounds of digging and scrambling are suddenly louder. The enemy made short work of the slates, and now they're going through whatever else is up there. With luck, that will be wooden beams. Otherwise, it's just lathe and plaster. They've probably got a couple of seconds before they have to deal with vertical incoming. But Rosie comes first, and she comes like thunder, the sweetest sound McQueen has ever heard. The bogeys up on the roof are hearing her too, and no doubt seeing her as she rolls up the steep incline of the main street towards them. Good. Rosie with her guns up is a terrifying sight. They must be shitting breeze blocks right now. The colonel can't take the corner cleanly. There just isn't room to turn something of Rosie's generous dimensions without hitting something. So he doesn't even try. He comes round wide, smashing through the frontages of shops, folding benches and litter bins down to two dimensions. Then he swerves at the last moment to scythe into the street they're on. Even so, he doesn't have enough room to manoeuvre. A lamp post is torn out of the ground and falls full length across the road, from pavement to pavement. It lies there like a toppled tree for half a heartbeat, before Rosie's treads crush it flat. McQueen grabs the radio. "Extend the airlock," he yells. "We need an umbrella." The massive vehicle comes to a stop at last, with the midsection door right opposite the door they entered through. The scientists scramble up and start to head for the exit, but McQueen brings them back with a terse bark. "Wait for it." The colonel extends the airlock, all the way to the door of the building. That glass is everything proof. If someone up on the roof has a gun pointed down at them, or even just a pebble and a leather strap, the crew will only be exposed for a fraction of a second as they sprint across from the protection of the doorway to the sanctuary of the airlock. Even McQueen would have trouble setting up a decent shot in that kind of time frame. "Okay," he tells his people, "lead off. One at a time, like before. Cover the civilians, then go over yourselves. Foss, you and me run tail." The geek squad is quick and efficient for once. With their lives on the line, they remember every combat drill they were ever put through, every skip and jump. They descend the stairs quickly and quietly. McQueen notices as Dr. Penny runs by that she is uninjured. Her duck and cover was a reflex, not a response to a wound. He lingers in the doorway, and Foss stays behind too without a word being spoken. They wait, rifles in hand to see if anything comes down through the ceiling, but nothing does. Finally, they retreat backwards out of the room and slam the door. When they get to the bottom of the stairs, the white coats are already scooting through the airlock doors, with Phillips and Sixsmith to either side, watchful and ready. They get the hell out of there, by the numbers. Only Khan seems a little breathless as they duck and run, a little clumsy, but then she's used to manoeuvring without a 7-month baby bump. Dr. Fournier is waiting for them right inside the midsection door, trying to look like he's actually got something to do here, yelping out orders as though anyone is listening. "Keep the platform clear. Leave room for the people who are coming in behind you. Cycle the doors as soon as the last man is in." The last man is McQueen. Foss, who was second to last, has shuffled in backwards so she can cover him as he comes. He gives her a curt nod of thanks and walks on by, trusting her to lock up behind him. "What if Stephen..." Dr. Khan protests, but McQueen isn't really listening, so he misses the rest of the sentence. He dumps his gun and climbs into the turret. The doors slide shut and the airlock retracts. Rosie backs out the way she came,
smashing a lot more infrastructure with her arse end. They reverse onto the main street, where they swing around in a wide, destructive arc. But not as destructive as it's about to get. The field pounder, in these close quarters, is useless. The shells would punch through the walls of Invercrae and sail right on. The flamethrower, though, is a different proposition entirely. The lieutenant slams down the priming lever and rotates the turret through most of a circle. He aims at the building they've just come from and cuts loose, sweeping the house from the roof on down. In seconds, it's one big bonfire. After that, he sprays the buildings on either side, with a view to catching anyone who saw the turret turn and jumped clear. Finally, he picks targets at random. Invercrae goes up like dry tinder around them and behind them. McQueen hears a yelling from the bottom of the turret steps, in more than one voice. He shuts off the primer, rests the gun, and descends to find Dr. Khan and Foss wrestling, while the men look on in various states of bemusement or horror. Khan was trying to get up into the turret and stop him, presumably, and Foss blocked her way. The lieutenant gestures to Phillips and Sixsmith, who restrain the doctor as gently as they can, pulling her off Foss like a limpet off a rock. "Motherfucker!" she yells, with the accent on the third syllable. She immediately tries to throw herself at McQueen, but the soldiers hold her tight. He sees Dr. Seeley contemplate a rescue, then very sensibly take a step back, as his sense of self-preservation kicks in.
"You bastard!" Khan shouts. "Stephen is out there! Stephen is out there, and you burned it down!"
He doesn't have any answer to that. He hadn't forgotten Greaves. He just didn't believe there was any chance at all that the kid was still alive. Or, if he entertained a doubt, a small one, it didn't weigh very much against the urgency of paying out Invercrae and her invisible residence for what they just did to Lutz. He is groping for a way to put this into words that Dr. Khan will understand, but she's still screaming at him, so he can't get any headway. It's right then that Rosie slows. Stops. The intercom hisses and crackles. "Friendlies," the colonel says. "Midsection door. It's Greaves. Bring him aboard." Khan is the first to move. She hits the lock. Seeley and Akinwe join her, quickly throwing the manual safeties that Foss has only just engaged. Only Foss, out of all of them, has the presence of mind to provide any cover as they pull the door wide. They've stopped by the river, just before the bridge. Stephen Greaves steps in. Nothing to say for himself. He just jumps right up onto the platform as the doors open, like a hitchhiker who can't believe his luck is in. His kit bag bulges at his side, even fuller than usual. "Thank you," he says. "I'm very sorry to have slowed you down. We probably should go now. The town is on fire." Chapter 21 "You violated standing orders," Colonel Carlyle says. "I need to know why." He is aware that he has said it before, and he is aware of how inadequate it sounds, but it is the least of a whole box of evils. He needs to adhere to the bloodlessness, the formality of regulations and procedures in the same way that Odysseus needed to tie himself to the mast when he passed by the island of the Sirens. The seductive voices in this case will lure him into anger, and Lieutenant McQueen will meet him more than halfway. "You didn't see what Lutz looked like when they were through with him," McQueen says, as though that's an answer. After a half-second pause, he adds a "sir," like throwing a scrap to a dog. The two men face each other across the long diagonal of the crew quarters, as though this is a duel. The rest of the crew stand around the edges, all except for Greaves, who is hidden in the lab, away from the dangerous emotions. The boy's instincts are sound, the colonel reflects grimly. His own men and the science team are all still stunned by what just happened, but as they thaw out, their reactions are tending to extremes. The soldiers are angry and hurting because one of their own is dead. Samrina Khan is furious for a different reason. the lieutenant's unilateral barbecue party far from forgotten, and her voice carries a lot of weight with the whitecoats. However this plays out, it has the potential to polarize them, to set them all at odds. So the colonel treads lightly. He stands by the book. The book isn't angry with anyone, and the demands it makes are ones the soldiers accepted the first time they put on their uniforms. "Explain to me," he says to McQueen, "why you fired the flamethrower in the absence of a direct order." McQueen shakes his head as though that's the sorriest excuse for a question he has ever heard. He doesn't answer. So Carlyle tries again. "Lieutenant, you used the midsection guns without permission, and without verifying that all personnel were aboard. If there was a clear and present danger that justified this course of action, I need to know about it. Because if there wasn't, you endangered the entire crew for no good." "They're still alive," McQueen says between his teeth. "All but one of them. All the ones who stuck with me. Did you miss that? I did what had to be done to bring us out of there. I secured a position, and then I requested an extraction exactly as per standing bastard orders. The flamethrower was just to let them know that if they hurt one of ours, we hurt them back." "Damn right," mutters Lance Bombardier Foss. Sam Rena gives Foss a look of incredulous contempt. She hasn't bounced back yet from the whole ordeal. Her face is haggard with stress and exhaustion. "Damn right," she echoes. "What, did they teach you that at sniper school? Somebody hurt you, you hit back with the biggest weapon you've got, no matter who might be in the way." Foss shrugs. "Nobody was in the way. We got out. We got out in one piece. And the ends justify the means, right?" She indicates McQueen with a jerk of the head. "You're a bigger idiot than he is." Foss arches an eyebrow. "Well now," she says mildly, "that's a conversation we can take up another time." Sam Rena talks over her, eyes on the colonel. "Stephen was MIA," she says. "He could have been in any one of the buildings this fucking moron torched. I don't know how this works, but I want some assurance that he can never touch those turret guns again. I'd rather take my chances with the Hungries." McQueen lets the insult pass. "In this instance," he points out levelly, "you would have been taking your chances with Junkers. And let's not forget that Greaves going off mission was the catalyst for all of this. Lutz was killed trying to find him and escort him back." "If I might be permitted to voice an opinion," Dr. Fournier breaks in, speaking as civilian commander. "With due respect, Doctor," Carlyle says heavily, "I'm attempting to settle a matter of military discipline." "Which impacts on the mission." "True enough, but so does everything. Which is why having two mission commanders never made any sense." "Lieutenant," Carlyle presses, "what prompted you to fire the midsection guns? Please explain." McQueen makes a gesture, palms up and open. "This is all I have to give you." "I suppose, sir," he says, "I fired them because I felt that Brendan Lutz's death mattered. If you disagree, feel free to discipline me in any way you see fit." The challenge rests there. Carlyle gathers himself to pick it up. "If I may be allowed to speak," Fournier tries again, "the presence of Junkers in the town more than justifies the lieutenant's action. I would be inclined to overlook the breach of regulations." "The presence of Junkers wasn't verified," the colonel tells him bluntly, and turns right back to McQueen. "You used the flamethrower contrary to regulations, in an enclosed and compromised space, and without regard to the safety of the crew. You were firing in a broad arc, ignoring the headwind and our own acceleration. Not only could you have killed Mr. Greaves, you could also have set fire to Rosie if the propane stream had blown back on us. I respect your feelings, but I can't condone your actions." "I can live with that," McQueen says. "I'm therefore taking away your commission." McQueen takes that blow full in the face. He blinks a few times as though to clear his sight. There is a silence that spreads out from him to take in the rest of the room. Even Dr. Khan can't find anything to say right now, although she nods just once. Good. The slamming of drawers and the clatter of instruments, Greaves, at work in the lab, seem to come from a great distance. Whether or not the demotion becomes permanent, the colonel goes on, is a matter for the muster's senior officers as soon as we're able to re-establish radio contact. He tries to temper his tone. The punishment is what it is, and it needed to be public, but there is no need to take the man's humiliation any further than that. Until then, your acting rank is private. The official reprimand will stay on your docket regardless, of course. Lance Bombardier Foss, you are now ranking officer in field parties and on any occasions where I'm not present. You will carry the acting rank of lieutenant. Sir, Foss says mechanically. She's just acknowledging the order. She clearly needs some time to figure out what it means. Permission to speak, sir, McQueen manages. His voice is tight. His face is starting to look a little taut, too, as though suppressed emotion is pressing on it from the inside. I don't agree with this decision, Dr. Fournier says. You're not required to, Carlyle reassures him. It's mine to make. Sir, permission to... We'll speak later. The colonel hauls himself to his feet, wincing at the pain in his damaged leg. Take a while to think about it, then come and find me in the cockpit. If you don't mind, Colonel, Dr. Fournier says, his voice rising now, I think there's a wider decision to be made, about the mission as a whole. He stands up too, rigidly tense, his head moving as his gaze flicks between Carlyle and the rest of the crew. The Colonel knows hurt pride when he sees it. Fournier doesn't like to be brought up against the limits of his authority. But there is fear in his face, too. He's not just throwing his weight around, he's serious about this. About whatever it is he's about to say. And what he has to say is serious stuff. It brings the house down. Chapter 22 The argument is ugly. But it is taking place in the crew quarters, so Greaves is able to retreat from it into the lab. He hates raised voices, raised emotions, words turned into cutting tools. But the upside is that it provides some cover for what he needs to do. He gets to work, doing his best to tune out the noise. The voices still get through, though. The loudest ones belong to Colonel Carlyle and Lieutenant McQueen, with each man repeating the same statement in a lot of different ways. Colonel Carlyle is angry with Lieutenant McQueen because he used the flamethrower when he hadn't been told to. He violated standing orders. He was in breach of regulations. The lieutenant is angry because the colonel isn't angry enough about the death of Private Lutz, which made using the flamethrower the right thing to do. He also says that it was all Greaves's fault and not his own. Greaves tries not to think about this last argument. Lieutenant McQueen must be wrong. It must be a lie, somehow, even if it doesn't feel like one. The rest of the team are angry, too. He didn't kill Private Lutz, because they almost died, and Dr. Fournier is angry. But what if Private Lutz died because of him? Because nobody is listening to him, even though he's meant to be in charge. He didn't, he didn't. He didn't, he didn't, he didn't. So everyone is angry, and Greaves has to work and not think about any of these things, but especially not that one thing. Private Lutz killed the boy, and the rest of the children killed Private Lutz. That was how it happened, and Lieutenant McQueen doesn't know because he wasn't there. Greaves feels the stinging in his eyes, the wetness welling and tumbling down his cheek. He can't wipe it away because he has put surgical gloves on, and he can't sob or snuffle in case the crew members hear him and decide to look in on him. He is doing something very dangerous and delicate out in plain sight. He bites down on his lower lip and glares through the filming tears. The lab has 10 freezer compartments for whole cadavers. 7 of them are full, the remaining 3 empty. Greaves unlocks and opens cabinet number 10, the one that in the normal run of things is least likely to be used. The one where he has been hiding his stealth suit all this time. He takes the boy's body from his kit bag. It is incredibly light, incredibly small, folded in on itself like a hedgehog or a woodlouse. Greaves puts it directly into the cabinet, which now hides it from any crew member glancing casually into the lab. Greaves is at war with himself. He is lying by his actions without saying a word. But what else can he do? Before Invercray, he could have told them what he had seen, what he suspected. He can't, he really doesn't think he can, say to them now, "I swapped Private Lutes for this. I'm sorry I didn't warn you, I'm sorry I didn't tell anyone what I was doing, but I got all I needed, so on balance, it worked out well." They already hate him, despise him, at any rate. Dr. Fournier will never allow him into the lab again, and nobody will ever speak to him, and the mission will fail, and Beacon will fall, and it will all be his fault. The bag has to be hidden too. Its bottom is caked with blood and brain tissue. The seams are holding the liquescent mass, just about, but dark stains are showing on the bag's surface. Greaves stows it at the bottom end of the cabinet, below the feet of the small cadaver and alongside the stealth suit. There is plenty of room there, since the space was designed with the body of an adult hungry in mind. He has to work. He has to find something, and then, when he has found it, he can tell them. It has to be that way round. Contamination of the specimen is going to be extreme and complex, but Greaves can't think of any way to prevent it. The exposed tissue in the head wound is crusted with dirt and grit from the road surface, an unidentifiable particulate matter from his bag. To remove it would take hours of work with the autopsy table fully extended, taking up half the total lab space, and the body laid out in full view. It can't be done, so there is no sense in worrying about it. The volume of the voices behind him has reached a new peak. Dr. Seeley and Dr. Akinwe are shouting at Dr. Fournier, which is troubling but also opportune. For the moment, he is unlikely to be observed. He exposes the skull on the side that has not already been laid open by the bullet. This will provide the cleanest sample he can get. He selects a 3mm bit and screws it into the high-speed drill. Setting the extractor fan on maximum to mask the noise of the drill, he quickly and crudely punches his way through the skull into the cranial vault. The smell of burned bone almost chokes him. The fan can't take it all away in time, so he will just have to be quick. Be done before they realize, before they ask. He retracts the drill, unscrews the bloody, clogged drill bit, and drops it into the freezer cabinet. There is no time to clean and disinfect it, and he doesn't want to explain what he has used it for. Selecting the widest of the biopsy needles, he slides it into the excavated space and takes his sample. Just as Dr. Khan, Rena, steps into the lab and comes up behind him. He can tell her by her tread, although right now it's heavier than usual, because of the baby, and more uneven, no hypothesis as yet. Greaves doesn't turn to face her. Reaching up to switch off the fan, he slides the freezer cabinet shut with his knee. He hopes that Rena won't track the movement with her gaze. Now he turns. "Wow," Khan says, wincing. She waves a hand in front of her face with exaggerated disgust. "Who burnt the toast?" It's a joke, not a real question, so he is not meant to answer it. But still the pressure builds. Greaves casts around for something he can use to fend it off. Rena does not look well. Her eyes are shiny with unshed tears, and her posture is rigid. These are signs he has learned to interpret, at least up to a point. "Why are you upset?" he asks her. "What's happened?" Rena shakes her head. She touches his forearm for a moment, one fingertip, their agreed and minimalistic hug, then takes a step back to compensate for the dangerous intimacy. "I'm fine," she says. "I'm fine."